Welcome back to the StratCom podcast. I am so happy that today we're joined by Dr. John Kelly. John Kelly is the founder and CEO of Graphica, a social media analysis firm founded on technology that he invented that blends social network analysis, content analysis, and statistics to make complex online networks understandable. And John is, of course, also a recognized expert on advanced computational techniques for measuring online behavior. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So prior to our discussion, I stalked you a little bit online, and in some previous publications and interviews, I've heard you say that we're entering a paradigm shift when it comes to our, you know, communications networks. Could you sketch out to our listeners what you mean by that?
Sure. It's nice to have some friendly stalkers online. Occasionally I get the less friendly type. I think we're well into a, you know, we're over a century into a paradigm shift in human communications that sets up, I think, a idea I always like to communicate about, which is the concept of cybersocial terrain. So let me see if I can step back. I know we have a little bit of time to unpack this idea. Hopefully we're not in a rush. But if you think of, you know, humanity, you know, humans, we're a communicative species. We're a social animal. And everything that we do together, be it, you know, good things like markets and culture or sort of more difficult things like warfare, happen through human collective action that happens through a process of communication. And we communicate fundamentally differently now than we used to. But if we kind of take a tour back in time, humanity evolved in geoterrain. So we were proximate to each other physically in geoterrain. All human collective action required communication that was bounded by upper limits of physical speed, right? The speed of a boat, the speed of a horse, the speed of a runner. And that's how we evolved. And everything, all the history we read about in history books happened by how we evolved in geoterrain. The process that kind of brings us now to where we are now with the internet really started with the technology of the telegraph over 100 years ago. Think about that moment in time when all of a sudden you could communicate at planetary scale in real time over a wire, and no more were you bounded by the speed of a runner, a boat, or a horse. Think of how transformative that was for human civilization. The way that empires were run, the way armies that were commanded, the way that trade happened, the way that you got the news in America of what was going on in Europe. Very quickly, the telegraph revolutionized human society, not because everyone had them in their home. I mean, you did if you were Abraham Lincoln or Queen Victoria, but nobody else did. It wasn't a consumer medium. It was something that reorganized the institutions of society by providing planetary scale real-time communication and radically transformative technology. Flash forward to the era of the internet, and what that has given us is the ability in principle for every human on the planet to communicate at planetary scale in real time with any other human. So the power that changed human society beginning over 100 years ago, the telegraph, now is the primary way we communicate. So all these choices that people make about who to follow and what to like in social media and the websites they visit on the internet, all of these micro behaviors of people condition algorithms and create relationships that form a type of network structure. They form online community, they form pathways for information flow based around the kind of collective manifestation of all these individual choices people make that sort of sort them into these online communities based on their interests, attitudes, affiliations. We call that cybersocial terrain. You can think of that fabric of connectivity, these very complicated networks, as a kind of cybersocial fabric. And when you start to think of it as a structured domain of that determines kind of how influence and information flow in the 21st century, we think of it as a terrain, similar to geoterrain. You know, so I think it's important that people kind of wrap their heads around this concept because it is now the primary domain of human collective action. So things that happen in geoterrain, you know, that have a sort of eventual manifestation in, quote, the real world, have often been brewing or conditioned or happening because of things that have been happening in the cybersocial world. Problem with the cybersocial terrain, unlike a real terrain, is that it's, of course, invisible to everybody. And yet it is the primary domain of everything we do, including great power contestation.
So building on this concept, what developments or what trends in the cybersocial terrain do you find most pressing, and where does Graphica, your company, step in?
It's a great question. So if we think about kind of the evolution of the internet, you know, the ability, the real initial transformation happened with what, you know, we now call the blogosphere. I guess we called it that then. It kind of seems like a long time ago. But remember how radically transformative that was, that an individual could put up a page on the internet and it could be in principle read by anybody else on the planet. Whereas prior to that, to have global reach, an individual had to go through some kind of institution that had access to a broadcast tower or a giant, you know, printing press. You had to have capital or state power to communicate at wide scale socially. And with weblogs, you did not. And so hundreds and thousands of people did that. And then after that, you had social media, which kind of took that initial capability to communicate broadly based on who happened to be interested and find their way to your doorstep to read what you had to say. And it really connected it to everybody. So it kind of took it out of the realm of journalists and kind of policy experts and took it into everybody's pocket on their phone. And so, you know, initially Facebook and Twitter, these kind of major platforms, that was kind of the next wave of things. And then I think what we're seeing now is a kind of complicating and fracturing of the landscape. So kind of era of big platforms is being supplemented by all kinds of niche platforms. And you have a proliferation of different online spaces that people inhabit. And so that's moving very quickly. We do a lot of work kind of in the sort of called information operation defense domain. So you asked about Graphica. We actually started out as kind of a marketing tech company, and it was the events of the 2016 presidential election in the U.S. that kind of brought us into the world that we work in now, where we try to understand how the cyber social terrain is being manipulated, who's out there pretending to be somebody they're not. There are a lot of ways to move information and narratives through that cyber social terrain using kind of artificial or inorganic methods. And that's where we put a lot of our R&D is into figuring out how that works and how you can detect it.
In discussions, both among policymakers, but also in mainstream media, when we talk about our efforts to fight back against, as you said, inauthentic behavior or, you know, disinformation, I think a lion's share of the attention is focused on these big tech platforms, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and so on. But in this country, for instance, a growing concern is posed by Telegram. It's becoming more and more popular as an avenue of Russian disinformation peddled by other hostile actors. Have you done any work on the kind of cross-platform flows of such content?
That's most of the work we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. So the way we evolved our technology, we think of ourselves as cartographers of that cyber social terrain. Mm-hmm. So my background, I'm a kind of computational social scientist, studied network analysis and, you know, kind of sociology of how people connect in patterns, and then invented technology using machine learning to kind of do the community detection or clustering of large scale networks. So that's kind of how Graphic got started. Where we've taken it lately is, instead of mapping out a Twitter network or a YouTube network or, you know, pick your platform, how do we understand how human communities form across many platforms? So that you might have a kind of a subculture or a political faction or kind of name your online community that comes together in a mix of platforms based on their shared interests. How are those constituted and how do you map those out so mm-hmm. you can understand what's happening there? Again, we think of that as kind of the foundational activity, kind of mapping out that cyber social layer. And then a lot of the work we do once we have that is on top of that, by understanding the message flow, the narratives that are spreading, trying to figure out who may be behind those narratives, which ones are organic and which ones are inorganic.
Could you maybe tell for our listeners about some of these subcultures that you have mapped? Are these some sort of dangerous people, organized criminals, or is that something more innocent, like, I don't know, hockey fans in Latvia? What kind of work have you done?
All of the above. I mean, we're interested in how humanity connects in the 21st century in cyber social space. And so we do a lot of work. I mentioned that we started out as kind of a MarTech company. So we have a lot of experience mapping out, you know, sports fandoms and, you know, electronic dance music subcultures and all kinds of interesting things. But of course, we are able to map out political communities, including sort of the normal good ones, you know, the natural range of attitudes in a functioning democracy. We do a lot of election integrity work. So, you know, if there's an election coming in the world, working with our customers that include the big platforms, we're kind of watching that discussion space and looking for people that may be manipulating it.
But we're not quite like Cambridge Analytica, right?
No.
Not this line of work.
They say a lot of the capabilities are similar in terms of you're applying certain kinds of mathematical functions to large scale open source data. But I'd say the intention and the customer base of the firms are very different. We have two very strong ethical principles at Graphica. One, we believe that the internet should be a free and open discussion space, free of manipulation and free of inorganic manipulation. And then secondarily, we believe it should be safe for vulnerable individuals and groups, you know, who can often be identified and tracked and harassed there. And so those are kind of our guiding lights. You know, unlike a company like Cambridge Analytica, you cannot hire us to get you elected in a country or to try and come up with a political outcome. We will defend the integrity of election all day, but we will not work for candidates. We will not work for parties.
I think all the dictators listening to our podcast will be disappointed to hear that. You know, so you mentioned the sort of partners you collaborate with, and one of them is NATO, of course, right? I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this collaboration, maybe nothing too confidential.
Nothing too detailed. Well, I think I'd say that we try to be helpful in understanding the narrative landscape across the countries that NATO is concerned with and around the obvious conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And we try to help understand the narratives that are flowing, the true ones, the false ones, also the global footprint, this conflict, and kind of the larger conflict between the values of democratic world and the undemocratic world that we're in conflict with. So we try to sort of help understand that narrative landscape and provide intelligence on what's going on.
And in terms of developing, we're investing in this sort of capability to map and understand networks. In your view, should the alliance invest more in developing these capabilities within the organization, kind of in-house? Or are there sufficient credible tools out there on the market?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure I have like the perfect answer to it. I think that there are amazing capabilities that are being developed in the private sector and kind of in the ecosystem of people that do what we do, work with large scale internet data. Also, you have organizations like NATO and other governmental organizations that have very specific needs, requirements, workflows, you know, types of personnel that deal with things. You know, so you often have to do a bit of a mashup between those things, understand how to ingest the value of the capabilities that can be provided by the outside world, but often you need to kind of wrap them up in a UI and that supports kind of the workflows that you care most about.
I think it's difficult these days to walk by and engage in any conversation where the term AI is not brought up. You know, it's almost a buzzword. It seems to feature prominently in discussions across all topics, all domains. What does it mean for your line of work? What sort of additional challenges or opportunities does it pose for you?
Yeah, so there are a lot of sides to that question, but I'll kind of take the ones that are most on my desk right now. So in terms of the effect it'll have on the world, because I think of the effect it'll have on the world and the effect it has on what we're doing at Graphica with the way we build our technology and our capability. In terms of the effect that it has on the world, if you think about one of the main limitations of kind of malicious information operations from state actors has been a resource limitation on personnel, essentially, right? If I did a lot of work for the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee on Russian manipulation of 2016 and spent 7 months looking at all the data that Google, Facebook, and Twitter gave the U.S. Senate on Prigozhin's operation, the IRA, and what they're doing in the United States. Spent a lot of time with that data. And one of the things that's very obvious is that you need humans to do that, or you did. You needed humans to actually
do
that work.
Troll.
You needed trolls. So basically your troll budget, personnel budget, was a major resource limitation on how much effort you could put into it, right? And you were always doing a trade-off between you could do high quality work at very low scale, or you could do very low quality work at high scale. You know, some of the kind of early online Chinese propaganda stuff that we were looking at we called spamouflage, because it's spammy, it's huge amounts of message traffic, very, very low quality, and in there you hide the political messages. The Russians, particularly the IRA and what they did in the U.S. in 2016, was more the low-scale, high-quality, like really crafting personas that could kind of penetrate a political community and make everybody think that they belonged and start to introduce their point of view. I think AI threatens to allow bad actors to do high quality at high scale. I think a lot of people, when they're thinking about AI and content production, you know, ChatGPT, the ability to produce sort of convincingly human text, to create deep fakes, you know, imagery and video, a lot of people think about the content, and kind of where their mind goes to is the interface between that high quality content and the human eyes that look at it and take it for real. That's not an unimportant problem, but I don't think it's the main thing that is transformative about this for influence operations. I think it's kind of the economics of manipulation. Because if you take away that primary resource limitation for, you know, a Prigozhin trying to run a troll farm, and you lift the human cost significantly, you allow that troll farm operator to do 10 times as much work at even higher, same or higher quality than they could do before, that changes the game in some really important ways. So that's the way I think about it, is how does it change the ecosystem? And you can think about the AI technologies, you know, NATO is a military organization, so, you know, military commanders are thinking about the tactical level, the operational level, the, you know, the strategic level, and it changes all of those things. Imagine the ability to create a personalized AI bot whose job it is to just work on you for maybe years, you know, and has access to all your past behaviors, or at least the ones that there are traces of on the internet. And its job, using whatever personas it can control, is simply to convince you of something.
Or maybe it would help me, you know, find a girlfriend, you know?
Yeah.
Have so much data on me that...
Yeah. So, yeah, someone will probably start a company to do that, right? But so there are tactical implications. Then there are kind of, at the operational level, you know, the ability to orchestrate operations, you know, pushing certain narratives, particularly the way that you can use some of the new LLMs to do high-quality translation. So imagine running a kind of multi-country information operation where you're able to rapidly create narratives and seed them with high quality translations, again, without all that human overhead cost. And then to be able to orchestrate all that stuff at scale across many countries. So it changes the operational level. And then the strategic level too changes, because imagine if you are in charge of, you know, that kind of information warfare capability for a major state government, how does that change the way you see the forces that you can build and command? It changes it pretty fundamentally, you know. So instead of one type of capability, you might invest in a capability that is able to build out, you know, deniable proxies. And we already know that's a major strategy, is, you know, build out a lot of proxy organizations. Imagine if you could build out proxy organizations at an order of magnitude more effectiveness and scale.
And in your view, do you think Prigozhin or the Taliban or North Korea, are they adaptable enough to actually seize these new opportunities?
I think it's the larger, more well-resourced state actors that'll probably have more success. I think that if you look at a country with tremendous technological capability and also already has a formidable kind of global propaganda capability, you'd look at China. Kind of below that, you'd probably look at Russia, but they're, you know, occupied with a lot of things right now. So it's, you know, I think that there are dangers from kind of the smaller non-state actors as well. But the ones I think more about are the kind of more large-scale systemic changes that will come from the large state actors.
So this is all very depressing and concerning, but I must ask, what does it create on the opportunity side? Surely it must also empower, you know?
It does. I mean, that's what we're working on all the time with our R&D efforts. So I do think that the first beat, you know, in my view, the advantages to the offense, right? But our job is defense. So how do we think about that? The way I mentioned, I talked about this idea of cyber-social terrain. And at Graphica, we sort of have a kind of, we call it the two-layer model. So we're interested in mapping out online communities around everything from, you know, sports to politics globally at the social layer. So the kind of social relationships that don't change very often, right? You change a little bit, you know, who you follow or what you like, but you've got a fairly stable set of social relationships that form online community. But then you've got a highly dynamic message, which is all the bazillions of messages that are flowing through that cyber-social terrain on any given day, right? And AI provides, what we're working on is several different kind of capabilities. One is, how do you do that network mapping using AI? And that's not LLMs, that's other kind of knowledge graph embedding techniques that we're working with there. But then all that message data, it's huge. It's very hard to get traction on. And, you know, we've got a world-class team of analysts that spend a lot of time looking at that to be able to kind of figure out what's going on and cook it down into, you know, an intelligence insight that a customer wants. But we're looking at how you use AI to scale that too. So the ability to kind of look at very high scale message data, find what are the major narratives in the messages, and kind of do a summarization that you can get in front of the analysts, it really saves a lot of analysts' time. We do not have high confidence in the ability of AI to generate kind of finished intelligence. You know, it's AI is very good at hallucinating things that in a convincing way, right? If you spend any time with it. And our customers trust the, you know, the validity of our insights and the talent of our team. We think, how do we scale the talent of the expert humans so that their time and expertise to validate and contextualize information is maximized? And they're kind of hunting around for it to pull it together to get to that stage is what the machine can do.
And what about using AI to kind of identify disinformation? Do you see promise in that, or is that still kind of beyond our reach?
That's a complex question. We know that AI is not very good at finding which content was AI generated, and it probably never will be. I mean, some people wave
their hands. Why is that?
Well, what AI generates is sort of, I've heard it called idea sausage, you know, but it's made from high quality source of like people's real and actual ideas. And often the outputs that it generates are fairly convincing and can sound quite natural. It's very hard, unless you've done something on the AI generator side to watermark it, and people are doing this, so that it is meant to be detected. It's very hard for some other engine to detect it. You know, even you have college professors, a lot of conversation about, I think I can tell, but I'm not sure, you know. So you're going to trust a machine to tell you that, right? And those evaluations are only ever probabilistic and never perfect. But I think that most of the ways that you would make it detectable by AI, including watermarking, are not going to be in the creation process of a malign actor, right? They will be doing it in a way that is meant to confuse those things. So even if the kind of the first beat is advantage offense, I do think that where you can look is how pattern recognition or pattern discovery of how things are spreading. I mean, another kind of problematic part about the question is disinformation. I mean, the best propaganda is true information, right? So we don't think of it so much as here's false content or true content. We think of it as, what are the narratives? Where do they come from? Are they being pushed organically or inorganically? And I think you can use we look at kind of patterns of propagation in network space. You can use that to identify those things.
Dr. Kelly, I wish you the best of luck with tackling all of these really huge challenges. And thank you so much for finding the time to join us here in Riga.
Great. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.